Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for May's Nurses Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome our speaker for today, RCVS Recognised Specialist in Small Animal Surgery Orthopaedics, Ben Walton. Thank you, Ben. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Oh, hello. Can you hear me? I think that should be on. Thank you, Ema. Okay, and thank you for the attendees to this webinar on canine lameness assessment. So, identifying and grading lameness is notoriously difficult. There are a number of scientific papers that have demonstrated poor agreement in lameness grading between observers and very poor agreement between subjective assessment, that is, a vet's or a clinician's or an owner's assessment of lameness, and the results of objective gait analysis, such as force platform, for example. So, I left general practice around about 8 years ago and went back to work at the University of Liverpool. And when I was there, I conducted a survey of all of my colleagues in the orthopaedic department. And I asked them what they look for, what specific gait adaptations do they look for when they are assessing forelimb lameness and assessing hindlimb lameness. Now, when they were assessing forelimb lameness, or thoracic limb lameness, there were six participants, by the way, in this survey. The answer was unanimous. Everybody looks for a head nod. Okay, so there is a fairly ubiquitous sign that we can look for when we're watching a dog walk or trot that gives us a clue as to whether they have thoracic limb lameness and how severe that might be. But when it comes to pelvic limb lameness, there was a different picture. There was no unanimous single marker that all of those clinicians looked for when they were assessing hindlimb lameness. And in fact, the top two, if you like, that were reported by the most clinicians here, only half of the people asked, were weight bearing at stand, which isn't really gait assessment, although it is a useful assessment. It's not strictly gait assessment, which was what the question was regarding, or skipping. And furthermore, the list goes on and on. So whereas with the forelimb, we had a very concise list of things to look for and unanimous agreement with the head nod being the most useful gait parameter to assess. With the hindlimb, everything seemed a little bit more difficult. And that certainly reflected my personal experience being pretty comfortable spotting and grading forelimb lameness, but struggling sometimes with hindlimb lameness. So the whole purpose of the research on which this talk is based and for this presentation is just to identify some key markers that we can look for objectively almost when we are assessing gait. So we're not just making this overall impression of how severe a dog's lameness is. We're actually looking for specific gait adaptations, deciding whether or not they are present and to what degree they are present. So we're going to look at adaptation to orthopaedic disease generally, and then the latter half of the talk is very much case-based. So we can think of lameness in its simplest terms as being an adaptation to pain. So when a dog has a sore focus on either a forelimb or a hindlimb, they are looking to reduce the pain at that point. And it's probably fair to say that the more force that goes through a painful area, the more painful it will be. So these adaptations that a dog makes could very reasonably be assumed to be efforts to reduce the force going through a painful area. So if we go right back now to GCSE physics and remember these equations, that force is the equivalent of mass multiplied by acceleration. I don't know if you remember that or not, but that's something that we learnt in sort of basic science there. And when we're talking about acceleration in this regard, I'm not talking about the forward, backward, acceleration, deceleration of the dog as a whole. I'm talking about the deceleration of the limb as it hits the ground on strike, and the acceleration of the limb as it leaves the limb on push off. So just to digress briefly into some nomenclature there, we split the gait cycle of any particular leg simply into stance phase, where the limb is on the ground, and swing phase, where it is going through the ground. And the two transitions are, as it transitions from swing phase to stance phase, that is poor strike. And as it transitions from stance phase to swing phase, that is push off. Okay, so they're sort of terms which we might use periodically throughout the course of this this next 45 minutes or hour or so. The mass, very simply, is the body weight of the dog that is distributed to that limb at any one time. So, if we break this down, the dog has opportunities to reduce both sides of this equation. The ways that it can reduce the acceleration of the limb are twofold. One, they can just slow down, okay, and that just makes sense. If you're lame, if you've got a sore leg, whether you're a human, a dog, a cat, or whatever, you're likely to move at a slower speed than you normally would. And as your body moves at a slower speed, that means that the impact with each paw strike, or each foot strike if you're a human, is lower. So that's a very simple, non-specific gait adaptation to having a sore leg. Yeah, we just move more slowly. But more specifically, animals can slow down the speed with which their limbs hit the floor. And that's something which I'll look at a little bit later. I'll show you how they might do that. The other opportunity they have to reduce the force going through a painful focus is to reduce the amount of body mass distributed to that leg at any one time. So let's take a little look at body mass distribution. What I'm showing you here is a schematic drawing of a dog's leg. Okay, hopefully you can see my cursor. But over on the left here, we have the dog's neck, if you like. And this first junction here is the shoulder. And then we have the dog's trunk or body. Neck here, shoulder here, trunk or body here, sort of hip joint, if you like, tail, back leg, front leg. And then if we move along up here, we've got the head. And the dog's center of mass is generally agreed to be at a point just caudal to the point of its elbow. So this is where the center of mass sits. You can see that it sits forward relative to the two legs. And this is all due to the head and the neck hanging out here, being a significant cantilever weight in front of the most cranial point of balance. All right. What this means is that the dog has the ability to shift that center of mass a little bit. Again, hopefully bring in another equation here. So this is another equation that is relevant to the mechanics of how levers work. So the overall force, if you like, or the overall leverage that you get from a lever is equivalent to the force that you apply multiplied by the distance from the pivot point. And the pivot point in this scenario is the shoulder. So just coming back to this equation, simply speaking, you know, in terms that you'll be familiar with, the longer your lever, yeah, the greater leverage you get from it for the same amount of force. And I'm sure that makes sense to most of you. Force in this equation is the equivalent to weight. So again, equivalent to mass really that's distributed there. So what this dog has done in this schematic now is it has lifted its head, and by doing so it has reduced this distance. So it's reduced this part of the equation. So the weight of the head and neck is the same, but the distance of the head from the shoulder is lower, which means that the overall leverage is lower, which means that what the dog has done is shifted its center of mass from the front legs to the back legs. Okay, and it can do that with a relatively simple movement, sort of relatively low energy movement there. The ability for the dog to move the center of mass forwards, however, is limited because dogs already walk and trot and stand with a relatively extended neck. So it's more difficult for them to bring their center of mass forward. Furthermore, as you do that, you're actually unbalancing the dog. So this head nod is, or this change in head position, is much more effective for redistributing mass away from the forelimbs than it is redistributing mass away from the hind limbs, which is why it is something that we see more frequently with forelimb lameness. That's not to say that dogs do not adjust their head position to offload their hind limbs. They do, and I'll show you some demonstrations of that shortly. But this change in head position is a very efficient way of mass redistribution, which probably explains why the head nod is such a ubiquitous clinical sign that we can look for. So we're going to get straight into our first example here. And as you're watching this, I want you to ask yourself a few questions. So obviously this is a webinar format. We can't see each other. We can't see what grades we're all assigning here. So this is an exercise for you to do to yourself. Maybe get a pen and paper and just jot your findings down. So the first thing that I want you to look for is, which leg is this dog lame on? I'm going to show you the video twice, so maybe spend the first video doing that. And as you watch the video a second time, I want you to assign this dog a lameness score. Now, there's lots of different ways of grading lameness. You can choose your own. If you want some guidance on a scoring system, the one that I use is a 0 to 5 lameness scoring system, where 0 is a completely sound and normal dog, and 5 is completely non-weight-bearing all of the time. Okay, so you can sort of see where this dog sits on that kind of scale. So here is our first video. Okay, and I'm going to play that video again. And we're going to get the opportunity to see it again in a moment, but hopefully you have had the chance to decide which leg it is lame on and grade a lameness. Let me just show you it one more time, just in case you need that. Okay. So, again, normally this would be a show of hands situation, but hopefully you've made a decision regarding which leg this this dog is lame on. Is it the left fore, the right fore, neither, or both? So it's not a trick question. It is a forelimb lameness. And usually what happens at this stage is that there is a show of hands and some people will have it right and some people will have it wrong. So let me play you this video again. And I'm going to tell you how I would go about deciding on this leg exactly what is going on. So the first thing I would do is I would watch the dog's head, and I would start getting into a rhythm in my head at which stage the dog's head is nodding downwards, simply by going down, down, down as it does that. So we'll do that. It goes down, 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 down. And then once I'm happy with that rhythm, I look down at the fore and I see which foot is entering paw strike at that stage. So it's going down, 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 and it's consistently the head is nodding down on the left leg. That means that this dog has a right forelimb lameness. So if I flick back through these slides, you'll see that the head goes up as the sore limb hits the ground to redistribute the weight backwards and off that leg. So that is a common misinterpretation that we see from particularly owners, occasionally vets and other professionals, because what owners will often say is he is dropping on his left fore. Yeah, he's dropping on the left fore, his shoulder is dropping on the left fore, and they interpret that as a left forelimb lameness, when in fact the opposite is true. So the head nod is a good marker for forelimb lameness. It is very often present, particularly when there is only one forelimb lame or sore. And don't forget that it's the head moves upwards when the sore leg hits the ground. So that is head nod and mass redistribution. So let's take a little look at the second part of that equation, which is the acceleration. Okay, more physics for you, more maths. Acceleration is speed Well, it's speed over time. And in this situation, I'm talking about vertical limb speed and the time of peak loading. So a dog that is lame will load their leg more slowly, and they will have the foot will be traveling towards the ground at a higher speed than a dog that is sore on that leg. Let me just sort of try and clarify that a little bit. So another schematic. What I have here, this vertical line represents a wall, okay? And this little figure here represents a force gauge, if you like. So the red bar indicates how much force this wall has been struck with. And then what we have here is a piece of string, okay, with a rubber ball tied on either end. Now what I want you to do is imagine that you take this rubber ball that's on the right side of the screen here and you throw it at the wall as fast as you can, all right? And what's going to happen is that ball is going to hit that wall with full force. Now imagine that you throw that ball in that direction as before, but at exactly the same time, or possibly just before, you throw this ball on the left here, you throw this ball over here, in the opposite direction. So what happens now is the string tightens out and the force of the ball moving in that direction slows this ball down. So it's still the same mass, the weight of this ball hasn't changed, but what's happened is the speed at which it hits the wall is less. It's decelerated by the fact that this ball is moving in the opposite direction and the ball hits the wall with less force than it did before, if indeed it hits it at all. Now, if we take that schematic of the ball on the string and we rotate it 90 degrees, what we have is a representation of a dog's hind limb. The hip joint, the knee joint, or the stifle, the tarsus, or the hock, and the foot. So, if a dog has a painful right leg, wherever it is on the leg, and it wants to reduce the amount of force going through that leg, it has the option of throwing the top of its leg, so the hip and the pelvis, in an upward vertical direction just before or at the time of paw strike. And this is our second video, which I would like to show you. So this is a high-speed video, so it's slow motion. And I want you to look for alterations in the vertical movement of this dog's pelvis and see if you can decide which leg this dog is lame on. Okay, so I'll show you that again. What I hope you can see is that just before the right pelvic limb, or the right hind paw, strikes the ground, the pelvis is moving in a vertical direction. Okay, so what this dog is doing is reducing the force with which its sore limb hits the ground. And that, I find, is a very reliable, very sensitive, and quite easy to spot kinematic marker of hind limb lameness. It is only really observable, at a trot in a rotatory or asymmetric gait pattern like a gallop or a canter. It's not really appreciable and it's not particularly evident either at a walk. But a trotting or a pacing gait, that is usually a pretty reliable marker for pelvic limb lameness, and it's probably the first thing that I look for when I'm assessing a dog with hind limb lameness. And I call that the pelvic lift. Okay, so moving on. What we've dealt with so far is dogs' general adaptations aiming to reduce the force with which a painful leg is being used. But the other natural assumption to make is that as well as reducing the amount of force going through a painful area, a patient is likely to want to reduce the amount of time that a painful leg is weight-bearing. So if you're going to be sore when your leg is down, you want that leg to be down for the shortest period possible. So with that thought in your head, let's watch this next video. And I'll give you a clue. This dog has a hind limb lameness. So see if you can spot, watching this video, which leg this dog is lame on. And it's a the benefits of this video are, A, it's a high-speed video footage, so you see it in slow motion. And the other is that it's a very big dog, so it has a naturally slow gait cycle. So if you're going to spot a difference, you're going to spot it in this video. So again, in a standard CPD format, we'd have a show of hands, and I can guarantee that a lot of people would not have got the correct hind limb lameness identified. The reason for that, I think, is that when we're talking about fractions of a second, which we are talking about for stance time in a dog's gait cycle, it is quite difficult for the human eye and the human mind to detect a difference in terms of milliseconds like that for the presence of stance time. What I find more useful is to look for the speed of things. So I think that we are naturally adjusted to detect differences in speed much better than we are differences in time, certainly over very short periods like this. So if a dog has reduced stance time on one leg, then the swing phase of the other leg has to be shorter also. Assuming that that leg's got to cover the same difference, it means that the swing phase of the good leg will be faster than the swing phase of the bad leg. So if a dog is lame on one leg, in order to offload it quickly, its other leg's got to get through the air more quickly. So let's watch that video again, but this time focus on trying to detect a difference in the paw speed during the swing phase between the two hind limbs. And let's see what we get from that. Okay, so I'm going to play it again. And what I think we see in this dog is that the swing phase of the right hind limb now is faster than the swing phase of the left hind limb. So you see this especially in the first few steps of the video. So slow, fast, slow, fast. And that is another useful marker for detecting hind limb lameness in dogs. That is especially useful in big dogs. It's especially useful at walk. It's not particularly useful at trot. It's not useful at all at a canter or a run. But in some dogs which are so lame or have other mobility problems that they can't get up to trotting speed, that is another very useful marker that is generic for hind limb pain. So, moving on, let me show you another video and I want you to decide what gait this dog is moving at. Okay, so what usually happens now is the delegates with a background in any sort of equestrian sport get this right straight away, and most of the people struggle a little bit. So a standard walking gait, which this dog kind of starts off at in the first step, the cycle of limb movement is, for example, starting with the right hind, it would be right hind, right fore, left hind, left fore, right hind, right fore, left hind, left fore. That would be a standard walking gait. If a dog was trotting, then the two diagonal limbs move together. So it's a two-beat gait. And what happens is the right forelimb and the left hind limb move together and vice versa. What this dog is doing is moving both ipsilateral limbs together. So it's left fore and left hind, right fore and right hind moving together there. And this gait is called a pace. Now, some animals will pace when they do not have any orthopedic conditions. Certain breeds of horse, for example, are bred and trained to be pacing horses, and these are used in various sporting events. Some dogs will also naturally pace, so some healthy dogs will adapt this gait, but it's a relatively inefficient gait. And there was a study done approximately 13 years or so ago now in the University of Helsinki, where they looked at various ways of assessing lameness and mobility problems in dogs. And they had a healthy group and a diseased group of dogs. And although there were dogs which naturally paced in both groups, the number of dogs that paced was significantly higher in the orthopedically diseased group. So if you see a dog adopting a slightly lumbering pacing gait like that, it is well worthwhile assessing those dogs for orthopedic disease, because many of them may have multicentric disease. So while they might not have one leg which is significantly more painful than any of the others, they might have multicentric lameness, for example, bilateral hip dysplasia and bilateral elbow dysplasia, which kind of forces them into this slightly unnatural gait. So not every pacing dog will be lame, and not every lame dog will pace, but there does seem to be some correlation there, and it is worth looking out for. That's a repeat of the video, which we can move on. So that's it for general adaptations to pain. And I think that the most important thing from that first section to take away are to look for the pelvic lift in a trotting dog when you are suspicious of hind limb lameness, and to look for a difference in paw speed, which is useful for walking dogs for forelimb and hind limb lameness, but especially useful for the hind limb. What I'd like to move on to now are condition-specific adaptations. A lot of experienced clinicians or experienced people dealing with lame dogs will often state that they can sort of make a diagnosis based on the way the dog walks. So let's have a little look at some condition-specific adaptations and try and decide whether that might be true or whether that is more likely to be bluster. So let's start out with cruciate failure. There have been a number of papers published on kinematic and kinetic variables of dogs with cruciate ligament failure, probably starting with Charles de Camp's paper, which was from the mid-90s. And this bottom paper here out of the University of Cambridge was published about 5, 6, 7 years ago now. Okay. As well as changes in paw velocity and stride length, as demonstrated in this second paper here, another adaptation, which is reported in de Camp's paper but also in other papers since, is that we see a reduction in the femoro-tibial joint angle in dogs that have cruciate failure. What that means is that dogs with cruciate failure walk with a more flexed stifle in general. So let's see if we can identify, having been told that, which leg this Labrador is lame on. So this is Rocky. He's a very cute but very goofy young Labrador with a ruptured cruciate ligament in one of his legs. And having been told that dogs with cruciate failure walk with a more flexed stifle in the injured leg, see if you can spot which leg Rocky is lame in. And I'm going to show you two videos, one from either side here. So pay particular attention to his hind limb nearest you, and make a mental note of how extended that limb is, how far forward it is coming. Okay. And I'm going to move straight on to the next slide and next video here. And this is going in the opposite direction. And again, have a little look at that hind limb and see if you can detect a difference between that limb and the other one. And make a decision in your own mind which leg Rocky has the ruptured cruciate ligament in. Okay, so hopefully you made a decision, and hopefully you got it right. What I've done here is I've taken stills from those two videos at paw strike of each leg. Okay, so top left we have the left leg facing us or nearest us, and bottom right we have the right leg nearest us. And I've attempted to freeze the video at precisely the same time, relatively. Which is just as the fall limb, just as the pelvic limb hits the ground. When we're measuring the femoral-tibial angle or the stifle angle, we place kinematic markers on the greater trochanter, which represents the hip, at a point halfway between the lateral epicondyle of the femur and the fibula head over the stifle, and over the lateral malleolus of the talus. Okay, and then we connect those dots. And I did this, and then using an on-screen tool called ImageJ, you can measure those angles. And what we find is that in the left leg, the stifle angle at paw strike for Rocky is 117 degrees, whereas in the right leg, it is 140 degrees. And this 140 degrees figure is what is reported as the stifle angle at paw strike for normal dogs. And this is a very much reduced stifle angle. So this is a good demonstration of a dog walking with a more flexed stifle as a result of cruciate failure. And that is one kinematic marker that we can look at that can give you a really good clue about what is wrong with a dog with a pelvic limb lameness, even before you've laid hands on them. There might be a good reason for this. Okay, so one of the or the biomechanical principle that underlines tibial tuberosity advancement surgery, or TTA surgery, which I'm sure most of you will have heard of, is that the reason a dog's knee is inherently unstable is because there is an angle between the patellar tendon and the tibial plateau of the tibia, which is obtuse. It's greater than 90 degrees, which means that when the quadriceps contracts during weight bearing, there is a forward pull on the tibia. Now, what happens to that patellar tendon angle as the stifle is flexed is that it reduces and it becomes less than 90 degrees, and this is called the crossover point. So now when the quadriceps contracts, the bare weight, there is less of, or there shouldn't be any, cranial or forward luxation of the tibia. So some people believe that walking with a flexed stifle is a dog's adaptation to dynamically stabilize the knee themselves. Whether or not that is true is kind of hard to prove, but certainly the presence of a increased flexion angle in a sore stifle when the cruciate ligament is failed is quite reliable as a marker to look for. Let's move on here to hip dysplasia. So that was cruciate failure covered. I wasn't expecting to tell you anything. I'm not hiding anything from you. I think maybe made an error in the position of that video. So let's move on to hip dysplasia. So again, there are a number of kinematic variables that have been reported to describe dogs with hip dysplasia. I think this is the video that was present before, so we'll play this now. Okay. So one of the main things that we can look for in dogs with hip dysplasia is a hip sway or a sort of Marilyn Monroe type sway. Now, some dogs have this and it is very exaggerated. They tend to be young dogs where the cause of the pain associated with the hip dysplasia is hip joint laxity. But some dogs with the sort of adult stage of hip dysplasia with osteoarthritis will demonstrate a more subtle hip sway, which is exaggerated compared to a normal dog, but not as exaggerated as it is in young dogs. And there is a tendency for the pelvis to swing more towards the lame leg than the other leg. Now, very often hip dysplasia, both hips are equally painful. But this dog, when we put it over the force platform, it had slightly reduced force or weight bearing through its left hind limb than it did through its right. But certainly on radiographs, it had radiographically severe hip dysplasia. So that hip sway is something that we look for when we are assessing for hip arthritis or hip dysplasia. But I would like to show you another video now. And this is another dog, which I think you'll agree its hips are swaying from side to side, probably more to the left than to the right. We'll just watch that again. And this dog did have a hind limb lameness. But what this dog had was a bilateral cruciate failure. And the issue being that when a dog has bilateral cruciate failure, it is forced to walk with both legs in an increased angle of flexion of its stifle. So both hind legs are walking with a bent knee. If you bend your knee, what you essentially do is functionally shorten your leg. So in order to maintain stride length, one option a dog has is to swing their pelvis around and give themselves an extra few centimetres of stride length. So sometimes a dog with a very pronounced pelvic sway or hip sway like that doesn't have hip dysplasia at all, but in fact might have bilateral cruciate disease. So that's one of those little banana skins which are out there for people to slip up on. Okay, moving on to elbow dysplasia. This is Desmond. And we've got a 50-second video here for you to watch of Desmond. So you have the advantage of knowing that this dog is likely to have a fall in lameness. So what you should be doing here, first of all, is trying to decide which forelimb he is lame on, or which forelimb he is most lame on. And for that, we're going to be monitoring that head nod. Down. Okay. Okay, so most consistently, head is going down as the right forelimb hits the ground. But there is something specific which we can see in just the last few seconds of that video. Okay, as he starts coming towards us. Okay, I think I have a still of it. Okay, so this is him standing. It's hard to see on that video, it's a little bit juttery. But as well as having the head nod there, which actually in Desmond was, I think, difficult to spot because he's bilaterally lame. Both forelimbs are very sore. He had very severe elbow dysplasia in both legs. Something that we see specifically in dogs with elbow dysplasia sometimes is this outward rotation of the paw. So rather than standing with their paw relatively straight and pointing forwards towards the front of the dog, they stand with this external rotation. Now, the reason we believe that they do this is to try and offload the medial compartment of the elbow joint. So most of the manifestations of elbow dysplasia affect preferentially the medial compartment. I'm talking here about medial coronoid process disease of the ulna, which is by far the most common form of elbow dysplasia, but also OCD, or osteochondritis dissecans, of the medial humeral condyle. So dogs with elbow dysplasia, especially young dogs in their developmental phase, the pain associated with elbow dysplasia can be quite focused in the medial compartment. By outwardly rotating the leg like this, what they're doing is changing the weight-bearing axis. So if we imagine the foot centrally here and the shoulder centrally here, what would normally happen is if we drew a line to connect those, that line would go straight through the centre of the joint. And we know from cadaveric studies that it's likely that the weight distribution in the elbow goes pretty much equally between the lateral and medial sides. By rotating the foot and having the paw out here, if we now take the point of ground contact as this point here, and the shoulder as being here, and you connect the line between those two, what we can see is that the weight-bearing axis is shifted from the medial part of the joint over to the lateral part of the joint. And this external rotation at stand and can be seen at walk and trot is believed to be an adaptation by the dog to offload the painful part of the joint and preferentially load the relatively healthy lateral side of the elbow. And this is a CT scan from one of Desmond's elbows, which just demonstrates the fissure crack running down there through his medial coronoid process. Okay, so that's it for the main body of the talk. So what we've looked at so far are the generalized adaptations to a painful limb, which includes the head nod, especially for the forelimb, the changes in paw velocity and stance time, which we see with forelimbs and hind limbs, but very useful at walking dogs with hind limb lameness, and we've seen the pelvic lift. We've seen the decreased range of extension or the more flexed stifled in cruciate failure, the hip sway of dogs with hip dysplasia, and the outward rotation of dogs with elbow dysplasia. So try and keep all that in mind as we move forward now through these case studies. So let's show you Stella. So this is Stella, a nice little Jack Russell, and you're going to see Stella trotting towards you. So I'm giving you a head start and letting you know that Stella has a forelimb lameness, but I want you to write down or make a mental note of which forelimb you think Stella is lame on. Okay, and I've no doubt that you've all got that, but just in case, I will show you again. This is Stella trotting, so a nice, brisk, quick trot coming straight towards you. So you've all made a note by now. You've seen that three times. Let's move on. Right forward, left forward, neither or both. They're your answer choices. And I'm going to show you another video of Stella. Same dog, same session, about 30 seconds later. Okay. And this time, Stella is going to walk towards you, a bit slower this time. I'll show you that one again. Okay, so I'm going to show you it again, and this time I'm going to get into my rhythm and decide which leg this dog is laying on. Down, 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 down. So I think the head is going down as the right forelimb hits the ground. And coming up as the left forelimb hits the ground. So on the basis of this video, I would say that Stella is laying on the left forelimb. We couldn't get force platform analysis, that's what FP stands for on this slide, because the dog was too small for our gait analysis setup. These videos were collected as some work that we were doing on a clinical trial, and Stella was too small for admission to that trial, so we didn't get any radiographs. But what she did have was consistently pain on left shoulder manipulation, so I was in no doubt that Stella had left forelimb lameness. But the point of showing you these videos is that that lameness is not visible, I do not believe, in this first video. So we'll just go back to that, if we can just get that first video up again. When she's trotting. Okay, so the importance, what this case shows, is the importance of observing dogs at more than one gait. Okay, so this dog was lame at the walk and sound at the trot. Actually, that's probably the exception to the rule. Most dogs, I would say, it's more difficult to spot a lameness when they're walking, and the lameness becomes more evident when they're trotting. But this dog, it was the opposite to that. And it just demonstrates, like I say, just to labour the point, that it's really, really important that you don't just observe dogs at one gait, and that you observe them at least at a walk and a trot. That's Stella. Just to talk a little bit about objective gait analysis, because I'm going to show you this value in a few of the upcoming slides, AI stands for asymmetry index. And this is just a numerical value which is applied to a difference in distribution of force between two legs. PVF stands for peak vertical force, so that's the maximum force that goes through a leg at any one time. And the asymmetry index is a calculation of the difference between the right and left legs, so R stands for right, L stands for left, which is divided by the average. Okay, so on the bottom of this equation here, this gives you the average peak vertical force for the right and left legs, and the difference between the two on top, divided by that average, multiply that up by 100, and that gives you a figure. Zero means it's perfectly 100% symmetrical. But studies have shown that if a dog has an asymmetry index of greater than 6, there is a very high likelihood that it is lame in some way. Okay, so let's have a little look at Max, who's a big Airedale. It's a tough one, this, especially as we are watching Max from behind. We see him turn around and come towards us now. But what I would like you to do is to make a decision as to which leg Max is most lame on. I would say that ideally we would have some footage of Max from the side, but we don't. Okay, let's move on to the next slide. So hopefully you've made a decision based on one of these options. Okay, so here are the answers for Max. So clinically, Max had hip dysplasia, hip arthritis. It was radiographically worse on the right legs. And he's lame on the right leg, and I'll come back to the video and show you that in a second. So what the asymmetry index tells us here is, look, he's lame on his hind limbs and his forelimbs, okay, and he does have a bit of a sort of intermittent head nod, but there's no obvious, you couldn't really pick out which elbow which forelimb was worse for Max. But there was a significantly higher asymmetry index for his hind legs, and he had reduced weight bearing in his right hind limb. And if we watch this again now, I think this is a case, and I do understand that this is difficult to see from behind, but I think this is a case where that poor velocity thing comes in. Because I think if we watch here, you can, especially towards the end of the run, there's a section in the run there where it's not so obvious, but let's just go back to the beginning. At the start there in particular, and again at the end, I think there is a difference in swing phase, where his left hind limb goes through swing phase faster than his right hind limb, indicating that right hind limb lameness. Okay, so let's move on to Tess. So another video or sequence of videos here. And I want you to tell me which leg is Tess most lame on. Or tell yourself, I should say. And I'll play that again. Now I'm hoping that you found that quite hard. I'll show you another video now. Here we go, this one. And this should give it away more or less straight away. So it was difficult with the first one because I was showing you Tess from the front. And the first couple of seconds there, you can see that there is a lot less weight bearing on the right hind limb, and there is certainly a faster swing phase on the left. But the reason I showed you this video is because when you see Tess coming towards you, she definitely 100% has a head nod. Her head is nodding up and down. But the difficulty is assigning which limb or which forelimb their head is going down or moving up on. And if we watch Tess from the side now, we'll see the point that I'm aiming to illustrate. And this time, get into the rhythm of when the head is going down, 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 down. And although it's hard to equate that with any particular forelimb consistently, what we can say is that it consistently moves down as the right hind limb enters stance phase or a paw strike. So although we talked earlier about the head nod being a kinematic marker that is especially useful for forelimb lameness, in cases of severe hind limb lameness like this one, it is also present with pelvic limb lameness. And again, it's another banana skin that I want you to avoid. So she had a lot going on, poor old Tess. She had bilateral hip OA, bilateral stifle OA, bilateral elbow OA. But just to prove my point here, the asymmetry index for her forelimbs was zero, or very close to zero. So there was no difference in the amount of force going through each forelimb, but there was a massive difference in the amount of force between the hind limbs, with an asymmetry index there of 66. So we're nearly finished, and again, this is another little summary table of the kinematic markers that we have looked at and where they stand in terms of their usefulness. So we can see that elbow abduction is only useful for the thoracic limb, and clearly the flex stifle and hip sway and pelvic rise are only useful for the pelvic limb. The head nod is most useful for the thoracic limb, but occasionally is helpful for pelvic limb lameness as well. And paw velocity is probably equally useful for both the forelimb and the hind limb. It's just that it is more often trumped in terms of usefulness by the head nod for the forelimb. We haven't specifically looked at stride length in this version of this talk, and that's because that is a more grey area that is probably less useful on a day-to-day basis. So like I say, we're nearly finished, just two or three more cases to show you. So what I want you to do is to look at this dog, and I'm going to show you the video twice. And the first time you watch the video, I want you to count the forelimb cycles. And when I say cycle, what I mean is pick a side, right or left, and a cycle is a step of both legs. So for instance, the right limb goes forward, then the left limb goes forward, and then that's one cycle. So if you just pick one forelimb and just count how many times it hits the ground, that will give you your number of forelimb cycles. And then the second time you watch the video, repeat the process looking at the hind, limb. Okay, so that you should have been counting the forelimb cycles there, and now count the hind limb. Okay. So this is what I got, 8 forelimb cycles and 5 hind limb cycles. What that means is that there is no natural gate where that should happen. The hind limbs and the forelimbs should always undergo the same number of cycles, whether they're trotting, pacing or walking. So what this means is that Sally has such complex gait adaptations to her multicentric orthopedic disease. By the way, she was neurologically normal. There was no evidence of spinal disease or neurological dysfunction. But she had such complicated adaptations to her multicentric orthopedic disease that there was no semblance of any normal gait pattern. And the point of showing you this video It's really just to illustrate the limitations of any grading system, or indeed any objective measurement of lameness. So no force platform, no subjective grading of lameness is ever going to come close to illustrating or recording just how severely affected Sally is. And that is one of the difficulties in grading lameness and recording lameness grades, is that that kind of process is useful for dogs that are sort of mildly to moderately lame. But when you get severe multicentric disease like this, any form of lameness grading is going to be thwarted with limitations. Second to last video, which leg or legs is this dog lame on? Now, you might find this one quite tricky, so watch carefully. Or not. So this is a little Papillon stray that was presented to me many years ago, walking on its front legs like this. And unfortunately for this little dog, it actually had bilateral leg Peard's disease, and we believe it had probably been abandoned by its owners because of that. The good news for this dog is that we performed bilateral femoral head and neck excisions that day, and that dog never walked on two legs again. It went straight back to walking on four legs and never looked back. So an impressive gait adaptation there by a lovely little dog, and a nice happy outcome. Okay, so this is the point where I will answer any questions that have come in. And just two questions have come in here. The first question is it possible by watching a dog walk alone to make an orthopedic diagnosis? Well, that came in, and I think it's fair to say that other than the adaptation, the condition-specific adaptations which I've covered here, which really only give you a clue as to what's going on, no, I don't think it is possible to ever make a 100% diagnosis based purely on watching a dog walk. You know, an experienced clinician will often give you a diagnosis as a dog comes across the car park, but that will be based on signalement as much as signalement and odds, if you like, just the frequency of diagnoses as much as anything else. I think that forelimbs particularly, a lot of owners and other people are very quick to attribute lameness to the shoulder. Like I said before, they tend to use phrases such as he's dropping on his left shoulder. But like we pointed out before, dropping on the left shoulder often means a right forelimb lameness. And being that elbow disease is more common than shoulder disease, it's usually not the correct interpretation. Another question is, what would stop a practice using an objective gait analysis tool? And the answer to that is it's a combination really of financial cost and time and convenience. For instance, a typical force platform setup would probably set you back around about £10,000 to £12,000 for the force platform and a few thousand pounds for the software. But then you would also need an area to set that up in, so an area of the practice set aside. But more importantly than that, it's the time involved in collecting that data. It would take at least generally 20 minutes and up to an hour to gather meaningful force platform data. And that's just not feasible in the vast majority of practical situations. So a combination of cost and time, really. That's it for questions, and I'm just going to show you one last video. And this is a gait change that is not a voluntary adaptation. It is very specific to one condition, but this is a really good example of a mechanical lameness. So this is where the changes that you see are not due to pain or due to the dog trying to avoid pain or adapt to it, but because there has been a mechanical change in the way the leg works. And what we've got here is high-speed footage of a German Shepherd. And as it walks, its tail gets in the way, which is very inconvenient. But if you watch very, very carefully, what you can see, particularly with the left leg, is at the end of swing phase, just before it hits the ground, the toe just flicks inwards. And the toe flicks medially and the hock snaps laterally. Okay, so you probably need to watch that a few times to see it. Okay, but it just snaps in there, very quick snap. You can see it, particularly on that last step is a good point to see it because the tail's not quite in the way, and that one as well. Just go back to the beginning. And this is something that you see in a condition called gracilis contracture, which is where one of the hamstring muscles, the gracilis, is replaced by fibrous tissue. And it's something which you see in other breeds as well, but very much a condition of German Shepherds. So that's just an extra little point of interest, really. So I'll just go back to that thank you slide. And thank you to anyone who's attended the webinar and who listens to it in future. And thank you very much to CPD Solutions for having me present it. Very much appreciated. Thank you.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Ben for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.